Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Thor Peterson. Thor is the winner of the Biggest Traveler of the Year Award in 2022 by Nomad Mania. He's an explorer and a modern-day adventurer. He's the first in history to visit over 200 countries in an unbroken journey completely without flying, aiming to become the first to reach them all by land and sea only. He ventures the world full-time and has not been home in Denmark since 2013. We talked to him at one of his stops in Fiji. It's truly an amazing story and lifestyle, and he's almost near the finish line. Here's a really interesting guy. Here is Thor Peterson.
All right, I'm here with Thor Peterson, a badass name, by the way. And, quite colorful. Everybody's got their own thumbprint of some. We talked to outdoor people in the past and the people have done adventures, but 200 countries by land and by sea, not by air. And he's from Denmark. I'm just excited to kind of get into how this happened. He's talking to me. He's in Fiji right now. So that's really cool. So let's go back. You were born in Denmark?
Yeah, that's right. I was born in Denmark, but before I could roll over on my stomach, my family moved to Canada. And we lived 4 years in Canada and then US for 2.5, and then came back to Denmark when I was almost 7.
Yeah. Where in Canada did you guys live?
I think we moved to Vancouver. We stayed there for 2 years and then Toronto for 2 years. Mind you, those first 4 years of my life, so my memory fails me a bit.
This is what's going to happen in the future. You're going to be going. And then where in the United States did you still live?
New Jersey. We're in New Jersey.
Jersey. All right, man. what a combination. All right. So you Denmark, then you go to like the California of the Canada on Vancouver. Then you're in this, Toronto, right? Or in Ontario and that area. And then you go to Jersey. You go back to Denmark. Did you go to high school when you were in high school? You were in Denmark?
Yeah, I did. Did whatever school. So our school system is a little different. We don't have high school and graduate school and this kind of stuff. But we just kind of put it together in different. I did all my school in Denmark. I went to business school and followed up with military service. I was drafted for the military, did 3 years military, then got into shipping and logistics afterwards, and did 12 years within shipping and logistics, working on a lot of overseas projects. And then I kicked off this project, going to every country in the world in an unbroken journey, completely without flying.
Well, let's talk about you working for the logistics company, because that's, although you can go to many places doing that, from what I know of logistics companies, because I have experience, being an entrepreneur importing a product, you are kind of confined, probably still, depending on the type of business. Were you in Denmark for that whole time?
Nah. So I started off in Denmark, and then after 4 years, I was pushing management really hard, saying like, "This is not why I started working within shipping and logistics. I want to see the world." So they sent me to Libya. That's not what I was thinking. Tokyo or New York or something like this. They sent me to Libya. Which was actually really, really cool. This was back in 2005, 2006. So Colonel Gaddafi was still in power, which I'm not going to say that he was a great guy, but the country was stable, meaning that you could actually travel around and not fear for your life. And Libya's extraordinary country. So I got to see a lot of that. And after that, I was the guy who had worked in Libya. So then they gave me a job in Bangladesh. I worked in Kazakhstan, in Azerbaijan, in the Arctic Circle, in Greenland. And they sent me to Florida for a bit, which was a bit of a change from all of those destinations.
Where's all this coming from? Why do you want to travel so much? What do you think started all this?
It's a good question. Maybe it's the children books or the stories that our parents, they tell us, or some childhood movies, this kind of stuff. My mother's from Finland. My father's from Denmark. So there's been a lot of back and forth going up to see a family in Finland for Christmas or summer holidays. So it got in early. And then obviously, I was a very early traveler with the Canada US stuff.
Right.
So it's second nature to me. I think it's more about curiosity. So I don't think it has to be crossing land borders. If you put me in a house, I want to explore the rooms. I want to see where am I. You put me in a building, I'll go up on the roof and this kind of stuff. And the world is my playground now. So I'm going from one country to the next and getting to see a lot of it.
When you were younger, did you know that's what you wanted to do? Or what did you want to do when you were younger? Did you know?
I wanted to be a ninja.
Ninja?
That. Yeah, I was.
Kind of like a ninja. Like a global ninja. Like very zen-like, you know, you're like Kane from Kung Fu. I always use that analogy, but you're traveling around, you know, you have that, you know, that was, you're an adventurer. You had the adventurous spirit.
Yeah. So I was intrigued by Indiana Jones was a big role model for me. Yeah. And lots of fictional characters. There was Robin Hood. There was Ivanhoe. There's Treasure Island. Lots of good stories. And we lived near a forest. I would go into the forest and pretend that I was somewhere else. And yeah.
How does this segue into, how do you get to do what you do, you know, to make it sustainable? You know, you say, okay, fine. You know what? The logistics company, they're letting me go here and there, but now I want to do this as my, when did you get the idea? This is what I want to do for kind of a living. I want this to be my life. When did you get that idea and how did you make it sustainable?
So my shipping and logistics career was at 12 years at the time. It was going really well. I met a girl. We started dating. And there was nothing in the cards that I was going to go out and do this. And my father, he sent me an email, which he's done hundreds of times. He sends an email with a link, something that he thinks might interest me. I click on the link and I'm reading about people going to every country in the world. And by the end of that article, I discovered that no one has done it completely without flying. And that I was 34 years old at the time. That just sat with me. Like, I can't believe that in this world where pretty much everything has been done, you know, the highest mountain around the deepest sea, going to the moon, like everything has been done. No one's gone to every country in the world completely without flying. Then, you know, I went, well, I'm too old. And maybe if I knew 10 years ago, I could have done something about it. But now I have a career and there's this woman in my life. And it just sat with me for a long time. And yeah, so I spent a lot of time thinking about it. And eventually I started toying with the idea and said, well, I'm definitely not going to do it. That would be crazy. It would be crazy to try. But if I was going to do it, give me a map. Where would I start? How would I do this? What would I pack? What would the budget be? Would you need a project name? Which kind of social media platforms would you operate? What kind of messages? What kind of partners? And, you know, just grow and grow. And eventually it was sitting there and I'm like, well, now I'm definitely doing it. So I left on the 10th of the 10th at 10:10 a.m. in 2013.
How special is your dad that he's like, you know what? No one's ever done it. And, you know, like, and you know, because most parents are like, you know, even globally, it doesn't matter where, most, not all, but we'll say it's like, you need something stable, you know, you need to like, you know, just do get a good, stay with your job and all that. But he knew that that was your passion and he said, you should maybe think about this.
No, I don't think that he sent that link and thought, well, we're not going to see him for the next 10 years. I think he's sent me so many articles and it might be about business. It might be about a hostile company, aggressive move. Like he sends me anything he thinks might have my interest. And when he sent me that, he thought, well, I'll probably just read that and then we'll talk about it at some point and then something else, right? but I took it to a different height.
All right. So now you're going to do this thing. You're planning this out. You're like, this is it. This is kind of like, this feels like this has been the moment of your life. This is your big inciting incident here. You know, you've been a traveling person. You've been an adventurer. This is like the biggest step. This is, you know what this compared to, you ever see the movie Titanic where Rose takes that first step on the Titanic, the camera's on her foot and it's just about to, this is a big thing for you. Cause you're, you know, so you map this whole thing out, you're getting ready to do this thing. How do you have, do you have enough funds in the bank for this? Do you plan this whole budget out? Are you planning to monetize this? What's the plan for this thing?
So first of all, did you just call me Rose?
Well, no, I wouldn't do that. You know, it's like, this is your Rose moment. This is your moment, like Rose.
She's an honorable woman.
Yeah, you can call me Rose. It's always a woman that does this. Like, it's when Dorothy steps into Oz, when Rose steps onto the Titanic. You know, I can't think of a guy that's actually, I don't know why, movie references. But like, this is like a big moment for you that you're saying, okay, I've been this guy. Now I'm going to do this big thing. I wish I, you know, it's so funny. All the men in movies have already been, they already entered like an Indiana Jones. He was already adventurer. I don't know. There was no moment where he became the adventurer, but this is where you become a full-time adventurer.
Alexander Supertramp in Into the Wild. Oh, he burns his credit cards and money, parks his car, and then he walks into it.
Yes. Right? Okay. Perfect. Good analogy. Let's talk. Okay. This is your Into the Wild moment. Of course, right. You don't die at the end of like starvation and eating the wrong berries, but you know, this is your moment. Not yet.
Not yet.
Let's not talk. How do you make this sustainable? How do you plan this out? Do you try to monetize it, or you know, is this going to be your life's thing, or is this an interlude, or can it give us a full broad spectrum of what's going on in your head, and how's it planned? This is a big thing,
Yeah, it's a really good question. A premise for me was that I do not want to come home. So I was 34 years old. And I planned this out and thought, this is not going to take more than 4 years, maybe 3.5 if I go a bit fast. That's roughly 1 week per country. And I felt like, well, that's got to do. And then 4 years is sort of like a university degree or like that kind of time frame. So I thought, well, I can do that within my life without, you know, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life doing this, but 4 years, that's suitable. So I knew I'm leaving as 34-year-old. I'll be back when I'm 38. That's what I thought. I don't want to come home indebted as a 38-year-old. So there's no way I'm going to do this if I'm paying for it. Someone has to step in. This is a pretty big thing. They must be able to raise funds for it. And a couple of companies came in. I have them right here on my shoulder, right there. So there's Ross DK, and Denmark is my country. Ross DK and Gea. These are geothermal companies, or companies that are invested in geothermal energy, drilling hot water out of the ground and making sustainable energy. So they came in and they fund the $20 per day budget. That's a budget which covers four elements: transportation, accommodation, meals, and visas. And they were covering that for a couple of years. So it's been going for 9 years now, not the intended 4 years. So for the first 2 years, they were covering the budget. Then they had to withdraw for a while. Then they came back a few years later, and now they're covering roughly 75% of it. So in between, I did some speaking gigs. I wrote a few articles. Crowdfunding campaigns, my followers online, they can donate money to me when they want. So, and I spent all the money on my bank account and sold a few of my belongings, this kind of stuff, sort of made it work. It's flattened out, it's become sustainable again financially over the years, but there was a gap in between where it wasn't so easy.
Right. As we're speaking right now, you can hear his, he has these glass blinds outside. He's in Fiji, and you can hear, what are those, birds or animals of some kind? You're like, ah! What is that?
There's a porch right here, and these crow-like birds, they like to show up. There's a dog as well. Then the dog will get up, chase them away.
That's great.
That's a cycle throughout the day.
So you're still in this thing. You're still doing it. And you know, is this more of like, you know, what would you say if you had to encapsulate the overall mission? Is this, you know, to just do it? Or would you say, is there, you know, me, I try to always like romanticize things. Are you going to write a book afterwards? You're going to like, is there like, you know, something that you want to do with this amazing experience afterwards? Or are you doing it while you're doing it?
Yeah, well, while I'm doing it, I'm updating social media. I do a weekly blog and, I do conversations, interviews, and this kind of stuff. At the end of it, when I get back home someday, hopefully sometime next year, the plan is a book, definitely a book, and then speaking engagements. And then that woman that I had in my life back in 2013, she became my fiance in 2016, and she became my wife a couple of years ago, and we remarried a month ago. When she came to see me in Vanuatu. So hopefully we'll be able to start a life and maybe even start a family together. So that's also going to be a part of re-emerging into society.
How often do you get to see her?
Well, so there's this thing where I let my beard grow up until the point where I see her again. So you can always look at me and see how long it's been. And this is short, as you might notice, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
But I saw her a month ago. 25 times. She's been out to see me 25 times. So we try to do see each other like every fourth month, fifth month when possible. It's a lot more tricky out here in the Pacific and on the other side of the planet compared to Denmark, where we're from. It's 2 days travel time for her to get here. And there's often delays and all sorts of tricky stuff to deal with.
This might be a personal a question, but that's the guy I am to ask these kind of questions to get the texture of the situation. And then do you ever have those conversations? She's like, Thor, I want to be with you and I want to start a family or do this or that, you have those conversations, but you're like, look, this is my cause celeb for me. This is like in my DNA. This is something I have to do. You know, what are those conversations like? If you could just share a little bit of that.
Sure. Well, the first one would have been back in 2013 when I said, well, I'm definitely doing this. I realized we're in a relationship. So what are we going to do? We're going to do a long distance relationship, or we're going to break it here and go separate ways. And I warned her about long distance relationships because I've been in a few and they never really, for me, they haven't worked out. Yeah. But we were in love and passionate about each other, and we saw something special there. And she said something which I think was nice. She said that as long as it makes sense, we shouldn't break up. You know, as long as it makes sense that we're together, we should stay together, and then we'll see. And then maybe you go into the world and we'll stay in touch for a while, and we find out it doesn't make sense, and then we'll stop it. But there's no reason to stop it now. It still makes sense. Well, okay. And then I left Denmark and I went through a lot of European countries and eventually over the North Atlantic to North America and so on and so forth. And it was good. You know, it's a modern world. There is a Skype and all sorts of ways to communicate online. And you don't have to wait for a pigeon to arrive or smoke signals. You know, it's a modern world. You can stay in touch. Like you mentioned, like I'm in Fiji and you're in the US and here we are right now. Right. It's just extraordinary. So we had rough periods, definitely. We had our ups and downs. But it wasn't like she was at home sitting on a chair, staring at a white wall, waiting for me to come back home. Like this woman was finishing her medical exams, became a medical doctor. Then she went on to continue with her PhD, and she finished her PhD. Then she decided she wanted to realize some of her dreams. And one of those was to do a full Ironman. So she spent a year training to do an Ironman. And then went out and completed it. And then since I wasn't back home yet, and she already had the equipment, she decided, I'll do it again the next year. So she's done two Ironmans now. She got a PhD. She started a career within a medical company. And her sister had a baby. And, she has a pretty full life. But obviously, none of us thought we would be in a long-distance relationship for 9 years. On the other hand, we have these unique experiences together where she's been out in the world with me in Armenia and in Sudan and in Jamaica and, you know, now in Vanuatu as well, and Australia, and like 25 times she's been out to explore the world with me.
Well, hey, look, you know, listen to this. If Thor can do it and his girl, why can't Tom Brady and Giselle do it? I just don't,
it's
working out for you guys.
They just don't have it, you know?
No, they don't have it like you guys. So that's great. So where are you right now as far as your journey? How much longer do you have to go? How many more countries? Where are you, in the middle? Are you a little bit? Are you in the fourth or third quarter? You're three quarters in? Or where are you at?
I'm at the very, very, very end. It's taken a bit more than 9 years to reach the first 200 countries within this project of 203 countries. So I'm down to the very last three. But because this project is unique, it has three cardinal rules. I can't fly at any point. I can't return home until I reach the final country or quit the project. It's up to me. And it must be more than 24 hours in each country to count it as a visit. So my average time per country is, I think, what the heck is it now? Around 14 or 16 days per country. My longest stay was getting stuck in Hong Kong for 2 years during the pandemic.
Oh,
and
wow.
The remaining three countries, because I'm not flying, and because it's not a small world. I know people say it's small, but it's not. It's a well-connected world. It's not small at all. So I'll have to make my way to Tuvalu, then come back to Fiji, and then from Fiji probably make my way back to Singapore, and then from Singapore connect to Sri Lanka, and then from Sri Lanka get to Maldives, and then I'm essentially done. But then if I want to go home without flying, then I have to make my way from Maldives and then all the way back up to Denmark and in the northern part of Europe.
So what projected time period is that? When is that date, you think, roughly?
Well, I think I can get to Tuvalu before New Year. And then sometime during January, I would be able to return to Fiji. And then the voyage from Fiji to Singapore is roughly 40 days at sea.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
So that is a January, February, March. And then, well, maybe then April, May. Perhaps around May, I could clock the last country. So
this is a very exciting time for you. You're in the home stretch there. This is like, you know, in 6 months from now, you're going to be, you know, that's going to be when you get back to the world, so to speak, your old world, your home base, you know, you're going to take a nice shave. Once again, you're going to see your gal, right?
Yeah.
And then have you conceptualized what that's going to be like for you emotionally and day to day, because you've been doing this for so long?
That's a good question. You know, I think, so I've talked extensively to people about this project over the years. Like, there's hardly a question I haven't had. And one of the interesting elements that's come out of it is that we think that in order to complete a project like this, you need three distinct characteristics. As a person, you need to be a problem solver. If there's just one problem along the way you can't solve, you won't complete. You need to be a people kind of person. You need to have social intelligence because you are reliant on other people. And if you're not getting the help you need, you're never going to get through. And you need to be stubborn like nobody else, like Guinness World Record stubborn, because you're going to go through tough patches where it makes no sense whatsoever to continue. You don't want to do it. You're in pain. Everything is falling apart and you have to push through. So you need those three at least. But then on top of that, I have this extra thing, which is sort of like a bonus in my personality. And I don't think you need it to go to every country in the world without flying, but it's certainly a bonus. And that is adaptability. I have a high degree of adaptability. So it doesn't matter if it's tropical or if it's, it doesn't matter if it's where I am in the world. You know, I could be in a desert, in a rainforest. I could be in a big city, in a small village, and so on. I find a way to make the best of it and sort of be happy in the situation. And hopefully I'll be able to adapt when I need to transition into a more regular world back home. But I imagine it will be combined with going out into the world and doing speaking engagements as well.
Right. Yeah. That makes perfect sense though, you know, because you're dealing with all this volatility and all this change and all this unpredictable, you know, day to day. So when you go back and you're like, well, this is just no different because it's just more, you know, it's unpredictable in the sense that, you know, it's become a little predictable. You know, you're going to have to go through, you're like, wow, this routine is more routine than usual. But like you said, you'll do other things. So is that the plan afterwards? You know, first of all, this is a Guinness World Record, right? This is like no one's done this. No one's else done by land and by sea, no flying, 200 countries. 200 or more countries.
Yeah. Well, at this point, even, you know, so most people who go to every country in the world, and there aren't many that have managed it, we're talking less than 300 people in history have gone to every country in the world, and more than 500 people have gone to space, and more than 5,000 people have been on top of Everest. So it's a really secluded club of people who go to every country in the world. I'm the only one who hasn't gotten on board a flight at any point throughout all of this. So, I mean, long time ago, it became a world record in terms of, you know, this unbrokenness, that it's just one red line throughout the entire world. And then without flying and getting the visas along the way and solving all the logistics and checkpoints and whatnot. So this world record, sure. I'm interested in world history. Yeah. I think that's interesting. And being the first to do something in our day and age, I think that's remarkable. So world history is flung around constantly. There are all sorts of, we made this person in parliament, world history, or this legislation, world history. I think there are some things that we latch onto a little more. And I can't quite explain why it would be significant to go to every country in the world without flying, apart from that it's unbelievably hard. But people have been to every country in the world. People live in every country in the world. There's just something really momentous about going to every country in the world completely without flying that makes it worthwhile to have a look at, I guess.
Sure. And if you ever, and if post 9/11 dealing with TSA alone, that would make you like a fantastic thing rather than, I'd rather like spend the extra time going by land and by sea, as opposed to going through, you know, international airports.
Well, I mean, everything in moderation. So, you know, I like chocolate. I love chocolate. But if I can only eat chocolate for 2 years, I'll go bonkers. And this stopped being fun in 2015. So since 2015, I've been pushing myself, going, well, listen, if I just push a little harder soon, it will loosen up. It'll get easier and I'll make it home. And then complication, this and that, then a global pandemic and so on. But the travel stuff as like a hobby-based interest, where's the temple? I want to see this waterfall. I want to meet people. I want to try this food. 2 years was more than enough for me to fill up all my senses. Beyond that, it just became a job. There are still some really nice experiences and there are some good stories and amazing encounters with people. It's almost always about people. I mean, castles and mountains is all good, but the people that I really, that's where I forge my memories and so on. But it's a long time to push through something that you really just want to see the end of. So we'll see. How can I say, the first time I got on board a container ship was magic. You know, you could not imagine the going up on the bridge and standing there and looking across the horizon, standing next to the officers and talking to the crew on board and seeing the engine room. The engine, it's like a house. The engine on board those ships is like three stories tall. And it is just exciting. I've been on board 34 container ships now. So it's a little bit like getting on a city bus. The excitement is long gone. You know, I come on board, hello, there's a part of routine and so on. I'm just waiting to get to the other side, get to the destination so I can continue doing what I do.
Let's talk about the container ships, because I purchase product from Asia and have it come into the States. And I get a spot in a container ship. There's a couple of dynamics about that. One is, how do you become a passenger on a container ship? Because that's not normal, right? That's not usual, right? Two, when container ships like became super expensive last year, because they went from like $4,000, you know, in 2019 to like $20,000 for a container. Was the passenger fee, you know, gone up in price as well? How do you get on a container ship, and what were the prices like during COVID? Or after COVID?
Yeah, I travel for free on board these ships. You have to see it as a form of a sponsorship, because as you say, it's not something that's done, and it makes no sense in terms of a business for the ship to take a passenger on board. So it's a management decision somewhere high up the ranks. And if they do say, yes, we want to help this guy, And there might be some incentive to do that. If they do want to help me, then it's pointless to start asking for selling a ticket or asking for, like, the money that makes, you know, just painting the ship might be $1 million US or more. So, I mean, like, what kind of money should I pay to be on board a ship? It's just, no. We're bringing the guy, then we're treating him VIP. He dines with the captain. He gets his own cabin, like everyone does on board the ship.
That's cool.
And, you know, he can walk around and take some photos and some videos. And then he gets off the ship at the end of it. There's only one ship where I had to pay, and that was in the early days, and it was symbolic. They asked me to pay $15 a day for covering my meals, which I think was right around what did that cost for the seafarers as well. And then a one-time fee of $60 US for insurance. And then that was it. So it was highly symbolic. And that was across the North Atlantic from Iceland to Canada. Apart from that, everything has been free. Now, you ask in terms of the pandemic. Well, during the pandemic, well, it's still the pandemic. So they haven't declared the pandemic over. But I got stuck in Hong Kong. So I was on a container ship. And I was in the north of the Pacific. I was in Federated States of Micronesia, trying to get to Palau. And the company that I was collaborating with, they said, we don't have a ship that goes from here to Palau. We can bring you here up to Hong Kong. Then you wait for 4 days. And then we have a second ship that can take you down to Palau. So we'll make the connection. We're like, that's perfect. So I got on the ship up to Hong Kong. Pandemic broke out. I got stuck in Hong Kong for 2 years. Jeez. So this was... 2 years while you were paying high prices for sending cargo. And a part of that was that the seafarers were certainly imprisoned on board the ships. Countries wouldn't accept the seafarer out of the risk of spreading COVID and contamination, this kind of stuff. So they got stuck at sea, and they do contracts for maybe 5 or 6 or 7 months. And suddenly some of them were there beyond a year. They were pulling out teeth because you couldn't go to the dentist and you got a toothache and it keeps developing. So your mate on board is helping you yank out a tooth. In two cases, the captain died on board container ships, and no country was willing to take the body. And they couldn't do a burial at sea because the family wanted to have the body returned back home. So they put the body of the captain in the cooler, and then the next in command takes over, and they keep doing their rounds. And every port is going like, no, we're not taking the body. We're not, like, contamination. We can't do this. So imagine the mental of being on board a ship, your captain's dead in the cooler, and you're lying there in your bunk or trying to, it's just madness. There was a high demand for ships. So suddenly ships were being quarantined, couldn't come alongside. Suddenly the ports had like half the staff that they normally have. Like, there were many, many reasons why the prices would go up in that period. I'm sorry for you though. And then in January this year, January 2022, I managed to get on a ship from Hong Kong and go to Palau. And, you know, there's a PCR test before you get on the ship. I'm quarantined in my cabin. I have to wear a mask all the time. They come in a space suit and take my temperature and do PCR tests on board. And then when I got to Palau, no one came out of their vehicles, immigration, customs, everyone was there. They stayed in their vehicles because of contamination. And then finally, someone puts me in a taxi and takes me a couple of hundred yards to a hotel. And then they quarantined me for 8 days in the hotel, even though I'd been at sea for 14 days. And it has been like this, you know, a lot of the time this year. You know, it hasn't been as sociable coming on board the ships because they have procedures. And it's almost a miracle that they do bring me on board because it's highly risky. If COVID gets on board the ship here in the Pacific, and the ship, for that reason, is quarantined by the next port of call, then they're sitting there for 2 weeks. And again, that's maybe $500,000 or a full million US dollars that you're losing. And they go like, are you going to pay that? Say, no, I can't pay. So why should we pay? If you're not paying, why should we bring you on board? So it's been nuts this year.
Who would have thought that would have been an aspect of your journey, container ships, and then compounded with the COVID situation? Off the bat, have you ever seen a container fall off on one of those boats?
No, I don't think it happens other than on social media, really. I do see the photos on social media. We have to remember there are thousands and thousands and thousands of these ships out there. Yeah. And they do anything they can to avoid a storm, heavy sea, and this kind of stuff. So they'll go faster or slower, or go around it and so on. And then sometimes something goes wrong. Someone's inexperienced or they're surprised by the weather or who knows what. And then maybe a container can fall overboard, but it's so unlikely, super unlikely. Right.
Rare. So, you know, what has surprised you the most out of this situation where you're like, wow, that was a highlight that I never thought would happen, but that happened other than COVID. What has happened?
Are we talking positive or negative?
But either more sensationalistic situation where you're like, wow, I didn't think that was going to happen on this trip.
I didn't think I was going to get married twice. So there's that. I've seen some stuff that I thought I wasn't going to see. I've had some encounters with people. I've been in some situations where I was just wondering, like, you know, you couldn't pay for an experience like this.
This
had to happen naturally.
Give us one. Give us a scenario.
Right. Okay. So in 2019, ahead of the pandemic, I had made it to Solomon Islands. And I was there for a bit and then waiting for a ship to come and pick me up and bring me to the next country. And that ship got stuck behind a typhoon somewhere up near Japan. And I was told, now you have 12 or 13 extra days before the ship will come. So okay, sure. Solomon Islands is gorgeous. People are sweet. It's a really interesting country. And I had a friend who told me, if you ever have the chance, then go to the west of Solomon Islands. And I was saying like this, I'm not a tourist, you know, I have all sorts of project related elements I need to solve. So I'll never make it there. But now suddenly I had my opportunity. So I work out where the ferry leaves from. I get on the ferry and it's really charming. So you have this ferry, lots of people on board, everyone's cool. It stops at all these tiny islands. A lot of these islands don't even have vehicles. It's just villagers. They come. Every time the boat stops, there's a small fruit market and you get off the boat and they give you a basket that they have been making from leaves and this kind of stuff. It's like really, really charming. And then you go around and you sort of think, I want a papaya, I want a banana, I want this. And then you pay and you get back on the boat and you sit and eat your meal. And I was sitting there together with, I was sitting alone. And then an elderly fellow looks at me and says, don't sit alone, come over here. And I said, come over to him. And I sit and talk. And he's the village elder. Yeah, he's not the chief. He's the village elder of a small village. And he says, where are you going? And I explain. And he says, well, how much are you paying to stay there? And I say, I'm sure we can do that cheaper. I say, okay. So wouldn't you like to come to my village? You know, we'd love to show you the village. You'll have a unique experience. It'd be amazing to have you as a guest. And I go, like, sure. So I take his contact details and I say, listen, I've already planned I'm going this way, but if I find out I have some extra time, I'll come to you. And he says, that sounds good. So I go this way. And after a few days, I give him a call and he answers. And then we decide to meet up on an island nearby. And we go to the local market, buy some stuff that I need. Then we get in a small boat and then we head to his tiny island. And he brings me in and this is paradise. So this small boat comes up on a beach and the waves are, you know, slowly coming up, palm trees, coconuts and birds flying about, children playing in the water, half naked, this kind of stuff. Where am I? So we start walking in and inland, and sort of like this flattened out area. And then there are three gravestones. And then he explains, this is where our village used to be. But a tsunami hit, took everything out. These three gravestones, that's what's left. That's my mother, that's my father, that's my brother. And then we keep going inland and then we go up a hill and says, this is where the new village is. There's this really nice village. Grass is neat and all around the place. There's a church or some houses. They have no running water. They have no electricity. They catch whatever fish they need every day. They coconuts and they rainwater and pretty good living. There are about 200 people living there. So it's a tiny place. Just surrounded by nature, palm trees and butterflies. And you see someone walking past you carrying sticks and firewood. And that, it's just amazing. So after a while, he shows me around. We sit and we talk for a bit. And then after a while, he says, so do you have a laptop? And do you have any movies on that laptop? Maybe something for the children. Because they don't get a lot of that. But like, I do. What should we put on? And he says, do you have anything with snakes? I think that would interest them. We go, well, I have the Jungle Book. How about that? He says, yeah, that sounds good. So we put on the Jungle Book and then we put the laptop in this house that has no walls. It has a roof and then these poles that are holding up the roof, but it's open to all sides, right? And so the kids are sitting in there. We're in the shade and seven or eight kids around my laptop watching the Jungle Book. And I'm looking at that going like, this is what? Look at these kids. And So the next thing that happens is that they finish the movie and then this village elder comes to me and says, okay, that was really nice. Now, do you think you have something for the grown-ups? You know, maybe something with war. I'm like, why would you want to watch something with war? You're living in this super people. Well, actually, I have a few war movies and I look through and I find that I have the Thin Red Line. So the Thin Red Line is a story that takes place on Solomon Islands. It's Americans alongside with the people from Solomon Islands fighting off the Japanese, right? And it's an amazing movie and that worked out well. And so now it's evening and we put this on in the same little wall-less hut and it starts raining outside and I'm looking out and you can see the stars between the clouds and you can see the silhouette of the palm trees. And then there are somewhere around 80, maybe 90 people punched down around my laptop, watching a Thin Red Line in a village with no electricity, no running water. I mean, that was astonishing. I've never, who has an experience like that? Who? So I just kind of leaned back and then watched that from afar going like, look what my laptop is doing in this village right now. I've never looked at my laptop in the same way again.
That's incredible. You know, I like to talk about movie experiences, you know, like, and I won't get into the, like, you know, but we talk about that, and that's one heck of a one where, first of all, how'd you charge your battery so much if there's no electricity for the laptop?
Yeah, that was it. It could show
those two movies. That was,
then that was dead.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, and in your travels, you ever come across a time where, you know, cause you could be in danger, you know, was there any time that your life was in danger in any of these experiences?
Absolutely. One really fast and easy way to illustrate it is that from all the vessels I've been on board, I know for a fact, and this is confirmed, that three of them are at the bottom of the sea today. So you go to some countries and you have ships that are in good condition and the personnel on board, the crew are professionally trained and you have safety equipment and all this and everything's good. And that's how it should be. But there are parts of the world where you go on board what is referred to as a soul cellar. And the idea is that the ship is in so bad shape that it could sink at any time and therefore your soul is for sale if you go on board. It's essentially like playing Russian roulette. And if you continue playing Russian roulette long enough, you'll run out of luck, right? I was fortunate that I made it across with these vessels before they sank. And at a later point, I had people reaching out, how did you make that leg? How did you go from there to there? And I gave them the details and they went to the port and they asked around and came back to me and went like, that thing doesn't exist anymore. That thing sank. And that's happened on three occasions.
What kind of boats? These weren't container ships, were they? What kind of boats?
No, like these two of them were cargo vessels, smaller cargo vessels. One of them was like a vehicle ferry and cargo. So I think probably you could have maybe 12 or 14 cars on board. And like relatively small vessels. And so these are vessels that would have operated maybe in North America or in Europe in their early days. And then as they get decommissioned, they get sold off to someone else. And then they get sold off to someone else and someone else and someone else. And then as it trickles down the line, people, they don't maintain the engine the way it's supposed to. They don't, there's rust. There's more and more rust that isn't mended. And the safety equipment is just stolen and ripped off and sold off to make some money. And it's just, they overload this. You know, if you're supposed to have 50 people on board, they'll put 500 people on board, right? This one vessel that appeared, I didn't get on it, was actually an old ferry from Denmark. I was in Central Africa. So I saw this thing coming out of the horizon. I was like, I must be tripping. Like, what the heck? Because it's so characteristic, the shape of them. I haven't seen them anywhere else. They're used. Denmark's a country with a lot of islands and we don't have bridges everywhere. So you have these small ferries that connect. And this was coming out of the horizon in Central Africa. And as it came closer, I could just see it looked like something out of a ghost movie. It's just in poor, poor condition. And I asked if I could go on board and said yes. And people were sitting everywhere. Everything was like greasy and filthy and disgusting and bugs and insects. And it was just, it was no good. And it still had these old signs in Danish about like a hot dog cost $1 or whatever it cost in the 80s, you know, like that kind of stuff. So on the back of that vessel, they had put these, I forget what's the word, like sort of like a scuba tank that you have on your back, but you put different gases inside. What do you call that?
I think a scuba tank, right?
A scuba tank, sure. Yeah. So they had maybe 100, 200 really large ones on the back of the vessel, which would have made it so heavy that if they would start sinking for some reason, they would go down like an anchor. It was just tragic, but that's like a classic soul seller.
Kind of makes you wonder how many boats are in the ocean. You know, how many like junkyards of boats do you think there are?
So many. You go, there are plenty of countries you go to, you just see the wrecks sticking halfway out of the water. Like there's no interest in removing them. So after the last tsunami, after the last typhoon, all these ships just got thrown around and wrecked and landed on the reef and this kind of stuff. And they're never going to salvage them. I met the German guy also in Central Africa, in this beautiful country called Sao Tome and Principe. And he was working on a deal. So he worked with scrap. He had a scrap yard. He worked with scrap metal. And he was trying to negotiate with government to salvage these vessels because he knew how much value they actually held. But it's just full of corruption and bureaucracy and super, super difficult. Now, I mean, I'm in Fiji now. You go down to the port, you look out at the reef, you'll see a ship on its side on top of the reef out there, probably from the last typhoon that blew through.
Have you seen a lot of those, pollution junkyards that you see them on like social media where there's like a sea of plastic? And have you seen a lot of that?
No, I've seen a lot of plastic for sure. There are many countries around the world where, you know, like the Maslow's pyramid of needs, and you start really, you need sleep and food and safety and security and this kind of stuff. And you move up to self-realization.
Yeah, the higher levels of consciousness.
If you're down at the bottom, you're not worrying about global warming. You know, you're worrying about, am I going to eat? Are my children going to survive? Or, you know, like that, that's your concern. So if you're unwrapping something, you throw it. And then you might come as a Westerner and look at that and go like, hey, you shouldn't throw that. But then at the same time, you look at, well, there's just waste all over the place. So it really kind of doesn't matter. It's like more a principle thing that you shouldn't throw it on top of all the other waste. But there's also the element of like, what do you imagine I should do with this? Go like, put it in a bin. Go like, first of all, there's no bin around here.
Right.
Second of all, if I put it in the bin, where do you think that they're going to put it?
Right.
Third of all, environment? Like are you crazy? Like food, give me safe. Like they're going to cut off my hands tomorrow or something. Like this is, I'm living in madness. Why would I care about this piece of plastic?
Right.
So you come through that kind of parts of the world where there's just junk and garbage and washing machines and old computer monitors and all sorts of shit lying around, and old toilets, like porcelain toilets just on their side and in a completely inappropriate place somewhere you would never expect to find it. And people just walk past it. Yeah.
Right. I get it now. I get it. That's the Maslow's, I think it's need psychology. Their need just for survival at this point. That, you know, they're just, they don't have time for that.
You know, the only reason why we're putting glass over here and paper over here and plastic over here is because we're pretty much at the top of that thing. We have, everything else is covered. Now we can start talking about, okay, we shouldn't mix all of this together. You know, this is why we're talking about what kind of light bulb we're going to put in. You know, if you're down here, you can't afford a light bulb. You know, forget, maybe have a candle, maybe just walk around in darkness. We're up here. You know, we have it all set. And these are important issues. No doubt that these are important issues, but you're not worried about it when you're down here. It's when you get up here that you have the energy and.
Got it. Yeah.
So actually, if we just add something to that conversation, we need to bring more people from here up here. That is important.
Right. But when you're in survival mode and you're just worried about survival, right? I mean, it's
hard. Gotta bring them out of it. You need to give them safety. You need to give them healthcare. You need to give them education. You need to give them job opportunities. You need to give them dignity and respect and soap and bring people up there. And that is what is happening. That is what is happening. More and more people are coming up here, but we still have hundreds of millions down here.
Aha moments. Well, situations where you've been like I'm not talking about a death, near death experiences. I'm talking about like moments where you're like, holy shit, I did not expect this. I mean, I'm sure you've had many of those. Any of those that stand out?
Well, I have had life and death. I was in a taxi in the middle of the night, again in Central Africa. Central Africa is a really tough part of this planet. We have some hard countries here and there, and it's government or sometimes a political movement. So, but Central Africa is just overall tough. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It has history and culture and amazing food and colorful birds and great diving and snorkeling. It's an amazing part of the world, but it's also just tough. You know, that's survival. You go into survival mode. A lot of the locals are in survival mode.
Right.
So here's another story from Central Africa. I was in a taxi in the middle of the night. I was rushing down to the border. I was in the south of Cameroon getting to Congo. And I was on my last day of my visa, so I was in a hurry. It might have been at 4 a.m. in the morning, maybe. There's just me and the taxi driver. We're coming down a road. There's nothing around us, no villages. There's just forest, jungle on both sides of the road. Once in a while, you'll catch the eyes of some animal out on the road in front of us. But most of it's just dust getting whirled up into the air and into the vehicle. We're coughing and sneezing and itchy, and it was just horrible, horrible night. And then suddenly the head beams in front of the vehicle through the dust. There are three shadows. And we come closer and they stop the vehicle, and we can see their uniform and their arm to their teeth. And as they command us out of the vehicle, you can see that they're drunk out of their mind. This is New Year's Eve. And they were not professional. These were the kind of, like, they were aggressive. They were not at their wits. They had their fingers on the triggers, which is something, because of my military service, this is something that I look for. You know, do they have the finger along the line of the rifle, right, or on the trigger? And on the trigger, accidents happen. You know, you trip, you push around, you sneeze, achoo, bang. So it was just a horrible situation. And then they get really, really aggressive when I step out of the vehicle, because I obviously don't belong in the region. And there's some colonial history. And sometimes that weighs really heavy with some people. Most of the time, you're fine. Like, people, they understand. People are just people, and we're all trying to get by in life. Some people, they just have revenge settings. And the moment that they saw me, especially one of the three guys, you could see fire in his eyes. And it was one of those situations where I knew, this is it. This is, you know, like, it felt like I was falling out of a building, and it's just a question before I hit the ground. I knew this was it. I knew that if I tried to go, they would shoot me. If I made a mistake, they would shoot me. If they got bored or more aggressive, or like, I was going to die in that moment at that checkpoint. I had absolutely no doubt. Life is so cheap in that part of the world. People die and disappear all the time. We never hear about it. And nobody knew that I was there. So even if people once come looking for me, they would never retrieve my body. It would be gone long before. It was stressful. It was horrible. And it went on for a very, very, very long time. Felt like it went on for a lifetime. But I tell you, every second I was just waiting for the sound of a machine gun going off, and then pain, and then falling down on my own body, and then maybe some laughter, and then that's the end of my life right there in the dust.
What happened?
But I stayed calm.
Yeah.
And they kept asking questions and asking for a variety of documentation, and I kept presenting, and I did whatever I could to not escalate the situation in any way. Tell you, it was violent and it was aggressive, and I just stayed as much a sheep as I possibly could. And then after 45 minutes, maybe, they just let us go for no reason I can explain to you. This came out of the blue. So maybe they got bored. Maybe they got tired. Maybe they wanted more alcohol. Maybe they just went like, get back to your vehicle. Well, shit. So we got back in the car and we got out of there like bats out of hell. And then I asked the driver to slow down after 4 or 5 minutes, and I got out. There was a big rock, and I got out behind that rock, and I just sat, you know, curled down in a little ball, and I was just shaking. And
wow.
That's completely out. And you know, this story continues for another 48 hours, and essentially it just got worse. It just got worse and worse and worse beyond that. So that was sort of like the beginning of a long story, which you can read in my book someday.
Yeah. Well, this is, let's go. You get back, you're going to write your book. You know, what's on your future here? To get back from this whole adventure and then write this book, and then, you know, go on speaking engagements, and are you going to like put your traveling days behind you? Because this is like such a massive long journey. Is it time to write that book, settle down with your beautiful gal, and what's the sunset look like for you? Or does it never end?
I think all of that. I will be the first person to have reached every country in the world completely without flying. Mm-hmm. I'll see how I can use that title in a variety of different ways. I travel as a goodwill ambassador of the Danish Red Cross. And I've met with the Red Cross in 195 countries now around the world, raising funds and awareness and asking people to join in. So I might continue to advocate on behalf of the Red Cross in the future. I think certainly book speaking engagements, go to the speaking engagement, bring a couple of books, try to sell them, see if I can get someone else than my mother to buy it. Travel there. There's some, like, because there's so many countries in the world that most people are unaware. You can put a number on it, but you can't quite. It's sort of like the difference between a million and a billion. Like, you can understand what you can do with $1 million, kind of. But $1 billion, your brain just doesn't understand anymore. And that's the same with the countries. People only really realize how many countries there are when there's a list and they need to read them out. And they go like, oh, how many was that? And you go, that was 20. Keep going. Or I have a list on my website and you scroll forever to go through the list of countries. It's so much. So essentially what I've done is I've traveled with buses and with trains, and it's like this thin red line that covers such a slice, but it's such a small little bit of each country in the world. And there's so much I haven't seen. There's so many places I haven't been. And there's some obvious ones I would like. I would like to go to Galapagos. I would like to go to Easter Island. I'd love to see Alaska. I think Alaska, I hear about Alaska. And when I went to Mongolia, it became super bureaucratic and logistic. I couldn't get my visa for China. I had to return to Russia. And I need to get everything in place in a few hours, or else I would have to wait another week for the next train or whatever it was. So I didn't see Mongolia. I just went from embassies and offices and train stations. I want to see Mongolia. And then the list goes on. I have great stories like the one from Solomon Islands, but that's because the ship got delayed and suddenly I had extra time. Usually it's like this well-oiled machine. You get your paperwork in order. You find your transportation. You do, you know, go through the list, tick, 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 and then onward.
Maybe when this is done, then you pick and choose, and then you'll it'll be a poetic moment when you're sitting maybe on a plane and you'll be thinking, yeah, we're just going to go see this one place or two places. But it really adds perspective and contrast to, you know, what you're doing right now. I think it's wonderful. Please tell everybody how they could find out more about you and your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So people are welcome to come and see what happens. The project is called Once Upon a Saga. So it's like Once Upon a Time, but instead of time, it's S-A-G-A, Saga. Once Upon a Saga, you'll find it on Facebook, on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. There's a weekly blog. There's a crowdfunding campaign right now for the work of the Red Cross in Ukraine. If you haven't heard about the war with Ukraine, then you must be, I mean, bless you, you're living completely off grid. But it is horrible. It's terrible what's happening. And we have close to 10 million people have lost their homes and been internally displaced or have crossed borders out of Ukraine. And a lot of those people do not have homes to return to, millions of people, because their homes have been flattened. And these are people who just, you know, they were playing PlayStation and selfies and going to work and school, university, and this kind of stuff. These are, they just lost everything. So the Danish Red Cross has been in Ukraine since before 2014. Denmark and New Zealand are the two least corrupt countries in the world. I think that's important. If you donate money to the Danish Red Cross, you can have some sense of this is going to where it's needed. The Danish Red Cross is in close collaboration with Ukraine Red Cross and working day and night, 24/7. And it needs funding. You simply can't put a number on it. So we've already raised $3,500 US within, the campaign has been going for 4 days now. Wow. That's a really good start. I've donated personally about 2,500 of that. And so you have to consider, I'm on a tiny budget and I have very little income. So I just wanted to put the first step forward and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Please come and help this initiative. So yeah, it's called Once Upon a Saga. You shouldn't have any problems finding the links to the Red Cross as well.
Wow, Thor Peterson, what a journey. How exciting. Thank you for sharing it today with us. And Looking forward to seeing you at the finish line. Thank you for sharing.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure.
That was super traveler, world record holder, Thor Peterson. Here's the perfect quote for Thor. 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things that you didn't do than by the ones that you did do. So throw off the blow lines, sail away from the safe harbor, catch the trade winds in your sails, explore, dream, discover. Mark Twain. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right, have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week, we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically, you're going to find it here. All right. Thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.